Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. We can talk about that later. I am pretty much good with all the essential oils you sold me last month, Ben.
But what about Bitcoin?
I don't need that either. But I do appreciate how you are always looking to equip me with the most essential oil and currency that is available on the market today. But we have a podcast intro to record. Amen. Welcome to the Gravity Commons Podcast. My name is Matt Tebbe, joined by my friend Ben Sternke, expert salesman, consummate entrepreneur.
Apparently not, if you keep saying no.
Well,
to my advances.
There are rumors out on the they're on the dark web. These are dark web rumors that you are in the top like 5% of yeah.
I think Twitter's the dark web now.
Twitter doesn't exist.
Whatever they renamed it to.
Been eliminated. Community notes. I don't know if you saw this. Community notes are now. That was a big Elon Musk invention, that he would create community notes so people could fact check.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Remember this was a big initiative by the free speech champion, Elon Musk?
I don't remember that, no.
Yeah, so he created these community notes. So there was like this great sort of meme would happen when people would tweet something and then the community would basically fact check them. And then the fact check would sort of be posted under the tweet and it would be like a big dunk, you know, on the person. But turns out, Ben, that Elon Musk is the single biggest purveyor of disinformation on his own social media website. And he was getting community noted so often that he has turned off community notes on his posts.
Just on his posts?
Well, I don't know if it's all across the platform, but like yesterday he called there was like this big dust up about astronauts stranded on the International Space Station. And I don't know all the details, but apparently Elon Musk was tweeting out that he had offered to NASA to send up some SpaceX rockets and bring people home, and it was political why NASA said no. Mm-hmm. And like literally one of the astronauts on the International Space Station like tweeted in reply to Elon and was like, this is totally not true. And then Elon Musk called the astronaut, the head commander of the ISS, an idiot and a liar. Yeah. And then, Elon Musk got fact checked by the community that, in fact, the astronaut was correct.
Yes.
And Elon got so dunked on and so his... Ben, powerful men have very, very tender egos.
It's very ironic for how much bluster they try to convey how fragile they really are.
So Musk turned off the community note that indicated how blatantly wrong he was so that his tantrum would look rational and legitimate. If that doesn't sum up 2025, I don't know what does.
We live in amazing times.
The dark web.
Yeah.
I don't even know how to access the dark web. I hear people talk about it. I don't know how to get there. That's probably good though, right?
It's probably good. Yeah. I mean, hopefully none of us are stumbling upon it willy-nilly, unawares.
Is there a podcast on the dark web? Should we get the Gravity Commons podcast onto the dark web podcast feed?
It sounds dangerous. I wouldn't want to be there.
I do Google Docs and Facebook. I do those in dark mode. So sometimes I like to tell myself that
that's just the dark using, web.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
when your screen's more black than it's white.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that's what it's.
I don't think that's what it is. No.
No. So if you need rocket launchers for your junta, or you want to create your own Bitcoin and run a scam,
You're in the wrong place. Listening to the wrong guys.
You're listening really to the wrong podcast. Hey, we're going to be, speaking of places, we're going to be in Nashville.
speaking of the earth.
Yeah. We're going to be in Nashville and we're going to be in DC in the next 2 months.
We are.
You have those dates, Spin? We're going to the Awakenings Conference.
Yeah.
For in the Missio.
DC area, Missio Alliance, Awakenings Gathering. Willie James Jennings is going to be there. Mm. A bunch of other speakers. Matt and I are doing a workshop there. That is March 6 through 8. That's coming right up. That's like less than when this releases, it'll be 9 days away, 10 to 9 days away.
Well,
That one's coming right up. That's the DC area. You can look us up if you're in the area, if you're planning to come to that conference.
I'd
love to meet up, say hello.
Would love that. We're going to lead a workshop on Friday about leading congregations through change.
Yes.
We know a thing or two about that. At least we know a thing or two about what not to do about that.
Yeah. We've had a lot of experience anyway. So,
yeah. A lot of change and a lot of leading and a lot of things I think we would do differently. So anyway, we're going to share about all that and hear other stories. So, and then we're probably going to be in Nashville.
Nashville. When's that one? That one is the Post Evangelical Collective. Is that right? Their conference, I think that's April 29th and 30th. I don't have it in my calendar. I'm kind of looking for it here on the internet, on the dark web. I'm looking it up. Evangelical Collective Conference. Anyway, I think it's April 29th and 30th. It's a Tuesday, Wednesday. It's in the Nashville area. Mm-hmm. Oh, there it is. National Gathering, April 29th and 30th in Nashville. Here's what they say about it. It's, we gather together with other pastors, artists, and church leaders in the post-evangelical space in order to connect, share resources, learn from one another, and discover that we're not alone as we seek to lead the church into new spaces. So that one's, probably a bit more focused on church leaders. So if you are a pastor and you are occupying that, post-evangelical space, that might be a great little gathering to look up. So,
yeah. Well, join us there. Come visit if you're in town. Let us know. Hit us up. We like to meet people that are connected to our community. Even if you're not going to those conferences and you're in the DC area, I think it's Alexandria, right? Virginia.
That's the yes. Well, Falls Church is the name of the actual suburb I think that we're in. So.
Got it. Yeah. And just, I'm fact checking myself. I'm community noting myself here, Ben.
Yeah. We didn't turn off community notes on the Gravity Commons podcast.
I always appreciate community notes. Elon Musk didn't call the Danish astronaut an idiot and a liar.
Okay.
He says, quote, "You are fully R word."
Oh. Okay.
And then he calls him an idiot.
Okay.
So he drops a mentally handicapped slur at the astronaut on the International Space Station.
Jeez.
There was a time, by the way, if you insulted somebody like that or a group of people like that, let's say you called... let's say you called racists who voted for your opponent, let's say you called them deplorables. There was a time you would not be able to live that down and in fact could ruin your political career.
Yeah.
And now
it's daily, true, kids.
Now daily we're dropping slurs to describe people we disagree with and popularity goes up.
Yeah. A lot's happened. A lot has happened.
Maybe we should get to our interview.
Yeah, we're getting off track here.
Maybe we're on track because we're talking to Jonathan Foster today, who wrote a book of poetry about dealing with the grief of his daughter's sudden tragic death. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the disciplines or one of the practices that allows me to metabolize and process the incredulity that I experience is to actually tell the truth about it from more than just panic and outrage, but actually moving through panic and outrage into some kind of sadness and grief and mourning. Yeah. And as I say in this interview, this book helped me to do that. And so maybe this is the perfect book for this time, because it is a tutor, a mentor.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk with Jonathan Foster. He's a father of three and a partner of one who exegetes culture from a mimetic theory and open and relational theological framework. Jonathan has been a church planting pastor, a podcaster, and serves on the board of the Open Network, and is the author of several books, including this most recent one, Indigo, The Color of Grief. He earned his doctorate at Northwind Seminary. You can learn more about him at jonathanfosteronline.com. Let's get into this discussion. Jonathan Foster, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thank you. It's very much, it's really great to be with you guys. I started to say very much cool to be with you guys.
Yeah.
You could tell I'm eloquent with my words.
Yeah, that's the poetry.
Yeah, exactly.
About poetry. Very much cool.
I'm better with the written word, apparently, than the vocal.
Let's hope same. So, Jonathan.
Yeah.
No.
Same, by the way.
Yeah.
Ben has the gift of emails, and we're talking about your book today, Indigo, The Color of Grief. And I got the sense, Jonathan, that, well, maybe you can tell us, was this your first foray into poetry, or is that a genre that you're used to and familiar with?
Well, I've always been interested in all different forms of art. I've always been interested in poetry. I like minimalist kind of stuff. I like trying to say, now you wouldn't know this if you've heard me preach or if you've read some of my other works, but I do like trying to say as much as possible with as few words as possible. My wife likes to remind me that sometimes. So this thing kind of, it felt like once I started getting into it, it was the only way it was really going to happen. And I'll just mention for the reader, when we say poetry, it's kind of like theopoetics, and it's not like rhyming poetry. It's more of a prose, a poetic approach to the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. This is just an aside, Ben. I think I figured out how to end our Sunday school classes on time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jonathan just unlocked the key for me. See, I try to say as many things as possible with the most words as possible. But Jonathan uses the least words possible.
See, that's the mistake you've been making.
I think this is it. This is the
we've finally figured out your one mistake.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Just one weird trick.
You've already alluded to the style. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. You mentioned up front that you write with little punctuation or capitalization, with sentence fragments and abrupt phrases. And frankly, Ben and I were in a text thread group, and this is how I've been texting and writing for a while now. Ben calls it my Rob Bell phase. But I do think there's something for me personally, it unlocks something for me, a voice, or I'm way less concerned about crafting things just right. But I'm wondering for you, did that style serve the content, and or what did you like, or how does your writing benefit from it being in that style?
By the way, is it okay to say that Rob Bell loved this book?
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Well, he'd love my text messages too.
Yeah.
He would. He would love your text messages. You should text him.
I did actually forward a lot of them to Rob Bell, and he was like, yeah, thumbs up. It all looks good. So
perfect.
Anyway, we've all got Rob Bell's approval.
I like how I asked if that was okay, but it doesn't matter.
He was kind of a controversial figure, like, what was that, 20 years ago?
Yeah.
When did that all happen?
He was probably 20 to 10 years ago. Maybe still is for some folks.
He might be. Probably not for our listeners.
Probably not. Probably not.
You're probably okay.
With respect to the way it's formatted, yes to all of the above. Like, I knew once I got going into it that I wanted it to come across as if I was talking. And I knew that if I were to be talking about grief and loss and the loss of my daughter, which at this point I have now for 10 years been talking about it off and on in different ways. I knew that if I was going to do that in a sustained way, that it was going to be kind of like this controlled, pretty flat, not flat as in not interesting, I don't think, but flat, like tone, kind of like I recognize that I kind of slip into this. It's a way I think I'm kind of trying to control all the wild, undomesticated, existential panic and fear and grief that creeps into this conversation. So that made a lot of sense when I first started going. My first iteration, it was basically just one long run-on sentence, but I quickly figured out that was probably a bit much. And yeah, lowercase, because like I said, I like a lowercase theology. It's something that doesn't shout, something that just feels more quiet and lives in those kind of the wake of an event, the wake of a big old storm. You know, when a storm comes through and it's so loud and big, and then afterwards it's quiet, you wouldn't shout in a setting like that. You would just speak normally, or maybe even whisper, because you were in awe of the thing that just happened and that you were that was still happening in a sense. And so all of that just kind of made sense to just keep it short, lots of margins. So metaphorically, people would have space on the page to process. Yeah. And I always kind of gravitate towards that kind of stuff anyhow, but this particular subject matter really lent itself to it. So it made sense.
Jonathan, we've already sort of mentioned this in an offhand way, just that it's a book of poetry and it explores the reality of grief. And you mentioned just now the loss of your daughter. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about like how this book came to be for you.
Sure. Yeah, it's, how did the book come to be? First of all, I think I write mostly because, not because I have answers, but because I have questions. And writing has always been a way for me to, as I'm moving words around on the screen, it feels like things are being moved around inside my heart, inside my soul. Yeah. It's kind of strange that way. So, but I've felt that to be really therapeutic and helpful. Also, writing is a way, as I kind of already alluded to, that you can kind of control a thing. I don't mean capital C control, but more like put borders and guidelines and parameters around this thing that you are experiencing. Otherwise, it's just, well, it's out of control. So I've kind of been writing about it, talking about it, preaching, speaking. Honestly, every single thing I've done since New Year's Day 2015, in one way, shape, or another, has been colored by living in the wake of the event. And my entire theology shifted. Frankly, my sociology and my ecclesiology and all the other ologies have shifted along the way as well. It's been an incredibly wild ride. And I've written about it kind of formally a little bit, but I've known this whole time that I would probably want to do something along these lines. I just didn't know it would kind of turn out like this. But long story short, it took me about 9 years to get all the other stuff out of the way, including a dissertation and a few other books and a whole bunch of other things. It's like all of that cleared out in order for me to get to these kind of like 12,000 words, which is all that this book is. Yeah. And to say it again, as much as I could say in as short amount of time as I possibly could. So yeah, there's probably a bunch of different ways to answer the question, but I guess I'll go with that.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're talking about it. I wonder if you would just read maybe that, the beginning of the book. I typically, when I open a book like this, I typically skip around.
Yeah.
But for some reason I didn't. I started at the beginning and I'm really glad I did, Jonathan. Yeah. Because I think the book suffers if you don't read it from the beginning. So I wonder if you could read one of the first entries for us?
Sure. How about I read? I think it's the first kind of like real chapter. It's called Absence.
Yeah.
Which is another way, by the way, Ben, of kind of answering your question, because I was really wrestling this whole time with what I'm talking about here in the short chapter. Mm-hmm. So it says, absence is protagonist now. It's weird. Absence is nothing, a nothing, but it's very much something, a something. It has no form, but it forms me. It has no energy, but it energizes me. I'm full of its emptiness. Only now occurs to me, 99 months beyond daughter of lightning, flash of car wreck, that all these words might be an attempt to absorb the shock, control the effect, fill the emptiness. As if the thingness of words can fill this wordless nothing. I have an image of youngest son, maybe age 5, poolside, struggling to get a toy out of his pocket. He's wrestling wet shorts, hands reaching, turning round and round. I watch him for a whole hour, 1 minute, as he spins, never getting anywhere. A boy chasing an object, like a dog chasing a tail, a world chasing a sun chasing a galaxy chasing a cosmos. That's me, trying to trap questions with my creeds, shadows with my candles, lightning with my eyes. That's me trying to address the nothing with me always.
We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling, and it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing. More transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
Your word about, you know, it being a theopoetics earlier, I think is, that's what I was struck by. I was struck by the sort of the juxtaposition of like you're noticing of the presence of two things that don't seem like they should or could be present at the same time, right? The thing and the no thing.
That's right.
I guess I'm noticing that a lot of, when I delve into that kind of writing and thinking, it often takes that form for me as well. Just like there's this feeling of, two things that maybe my theology has taught me, they're opposed to one another, can't be present, can't be in the same place at the same time. But, I really appreciated the way that you pulled absence and presence together.
Thank you. Thanks for your comments.
Yeah.
Something I noticed too about, and the book is really maybe an expression and exploration of grief. Mm-hmm. But I noticed as I read, there's these suggestions that you lost your daughter, which are very subtle, but also I think arrest you as you read, arrested me. And I noticed, Jonathan, and I'd love to get your comment on this as it relates to grief. I noticed as I read, I immediately had lots of questions. In my mind, I was like, what happened? Mm-hmm. How did this happen? Does Jonathan talk about this anywhere? I wonder if I could Google it and figure out what happened. I want to know what happened. But there was another part of me, man, and this is the power, I think, of not only your prose, but grief. There was another part of me that was like, no, you don't need to know what happened. Mm-hmm. Because what's important here aren't the details or the history. What's important here is this really visceral experience I'm having as I read this poem and getting in touch with my own no thing that's something. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could speak for a bit about this desire or need that I'm confessing to you. Is this okay to confess this to you? Yeah. That I wanted to figure it out. Yeah. I wanted it explained. Mm-hmm. And how I feel like maybe grief resists that, or the way to come to or around or by or through grief is not by way of explanation. I wonder if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah, those are really good comments. Thank you. It totally makes sense. I've had other people, especially those who were uninitiated with my work or didn't know me at all, who wanted to know more of the details. And I think that is totally understandable. I think all of us are like that. And in a way, like I was saying earlier, you know, you're trying to kind of determine, like all of us go through life trying to make meaning out of the stuff that we hear and see and feel. And you only do that through, you know, your senses. And so the more information that you can gather, the better you can make sense of it all. So I don't think you should feel bad about that at all. And I wrestled with that a little bit, but I kind of wound up sticking to a little bit vaguer, more artistic approach, in part because I was worried I didn't want to co-opt the story, a deeper story of what I think is happening here, which is beauty and grief and loss and humanity and love and God. Those are not proprietary to Jonathan. Mm-hmm. You know, those are a human thing. And I knew at some level that if I could be slightly more vague, that it would help all of us and help the reader figure out how it works in their story. Yeah. And it kind of turned out that way. I probably wasn't quite that conscious that I was doing that. There was a little bit of that, but I was conscious a little bit of it. And I can tell that it kind of worked that way, because everyone who's engaged with the story, some people I can tell they read it and they haven't really engaged, and that's fine. But there's always, it's like a prism. Everyone that talks about it, they turn it a little bit different way, and it refracts a little bit different light. And I don't think that's just because what I wrote is cool. It's just something kind of special happened with the muse and the artistry of some spirit and the people reading it, so that people are allowing it to say different things to them. But to be clear, New Year's Day, 2015, 4:30 PM, our daughter was killed in a car, in a ice storm in Southeast Kansas. Mm. And that's the, you know, kind of the detail. She was 20 years old, right on the verge of becoming adult, right on the verge of becoming next, you know, whatever was next in her life. So like I say in the book, in the springtime of her life, you know, she died in winter, which was the springtime of her life, which was just another odd paradox. Yeah. But I think you're getting at something that's it's important, and I'm probably not saying it very well, but it speaks to the universality for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I can definitely appreciate your approach with that, because I think there is something that sometimes kicks in when we want to know the details of someone else's story, especially if it's tragic. that I don't even know if I have words for this, but like there's almost like a voyeurism or a, you know what I mean? That can take over where we're like, oh, how terrible for him or how terrible for that family, you know, that kind of thing that doesn't actually, it serves to create distance between you and me.
It might.
When what you're trying to do is to create connection, to say, yeah, I'm not the only person who grieves. And I'm not just telling my story so that you can feel sorry for me or something. Like I'm processing through something that is actually quite universal for humans.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Well, personally, I felt like it was an escape hatch for me not to be in touch with my own grief. Mm. I feel like it's easier for me to be curious about what happened than it is to tune into the way that, you know, the very vivid, descriptive pictures ping off of my body, ping in my body, and the grief that I carry about my own things. Mm-hmm. It's just I'd rather be curious about some details than tune into what's actually happening. I think that's what's going on for me. But I did appreciate, I think, Jonathan, the way that you left that space, and you called it vagaries, but to me it was much more of like, and this is where I think the style contributes to how you sort of allude to this, is that there's like, I'm catching a little bit of a conversation that's super long. And that little bit of a conversation is like, I bet that is fascinating. I want to know more about that.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do. It's hard to do from an artistic perspective without like playing or taunting the reader or just being like too cheeky by half. And so it's one of the strengths of the books. I'm not even asking a question at this point. I'm just sort of like affirming that I feel like the style and that space that the style creates was beneficial for me.
Thank you. It makes me think of Marsha McLuhan's line, "The medium is the message."
Oh,
you guys
are
probably familiar with that. That is what turned. That's what happened here. Like the way it's presented says as much about what's going on as the things that we're talking about. So that was kind of cool to have all that happen. I'm grateful for that.
I want to invite you to read maybe the portion right after that what you just read.
Sure.
But before you do, because this is our first time talking to you, and you do a lot of things, which I said in the intro, listener, you've already heard them. But I'm curious, like you referenced that this was a watershed moment, not just for you as a father, but like it changed your theology and it changed the trajectory of your life. Could you reflect just a bit for us? What are some of the most seminal ways that has changed you?
Yeah, well, there's no corner of my life that's not been touched by the shadow of grief. And there's no corner that's not been touched by some light of beauty. It's all kind of been wrapped up together. So it would be impossible to pick one thing. But having said that, the first thing that came to mind when you asked is something to do with me as a father, as a parent, and the love that I had for this kid, and how weird it was that she was gone, like literally in a heartbeat. Her heart stopped beating and she was gone. And yet the love I had and the love that we all had, her mom, my wife, you know, her brothers, was still being generated. You keep generating this love, but it's just not reciprocated in the way that it used to be. It's like a ping with no pong. It's the oddest thing. And again, that kind of played into like, oh, this absence now becomes a presence because that love is so still active. And it still is 10 years later, though it kind of ebbs and flows in its intensity depending on, you know, my day. But I began to theologically superimpose, maybe that's a word, infuse, like all of that kind of thinking into what I imagined might be going on with God and or with me in the midst of my interaction with God and creation. And it just started sparking endless, fascinating conversations within me that frankly, are still going of, well, what does that say about the divine? What does that say about the fact that God could experience loss? Like, what if God's like that with all of us? You know, as we experience loss, and now there's a loss inside of him, but or her or it or whatever, that continues to generate, you know, and then it prompted me to think about lines like Pascal, you know, who talked about the God-shaped hole inside of each of us. And then I began to flipping that around, thinking, oh, maybe there's an us-shaped hole inside of God. And the holes, and not only the holes, but the H-O-L-E inside of the W-H-O-L-E. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if any of that makes sense. Again, better writer than talker. But all that stuff, I just kept double-clicking on, like double-click, and it's mm-hmm. I still keep going, and it's really changed. Turns out it's kind of changed everything. It meant that I had to let go of a lot of old stuff. And by the way, a lot of that old stuff and the environment out of which it came from, I mean, those are full of good people and good stuff, but it was just time for that to be shed and to let go of. And then it's allowed me to go deeper. And I mean, I'm not thankful obviously for the specific loss, but I am really, really thankful for, you know, the journey that I've been on. And all of it has been marked, like genuinely for me, by a desire to know more and be curious more about what love is. And maybe God actually really is love. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, I'm struck by the loss of love. Mm-hmm. Sort of then brings you more fully face to face with it. And you know, the second passage I asked you to read, it immediately follows absence is entitled Loved.
Yeah.
And I think it would be perhaps apt if you would, regale us with,
let's do it,
a reading.
Let's do it. All right. This is called Loved. Loved being a dad, loved being her dad, bedtime prayers, shoulder growing damp, her hair wet from evening bath, making up jokes, songs, choir concerts, shafts of light, high school auditoriums, smiling shoulder, touching wife's shoulder, smiling, staying late after soccer practice, teammates waving, her and I kicking the ball, lights going out one by one, Taco Bell drive-thru on the way home. I do some things differently, but thankfully there are few regrets, though I do have one for sure. She was about 10, midlife, at a soccer tournament. Four games over the weekend, each played with less desire than the one before. With other girls heading to cars, sucking on orange slices, receiving accolades from grandparents who had flown all the way from Minnesota to see such terrific soccer, my daughter followed my pointing finger back out onto the field. She kicked and dribbled and ran with me, and all the expectations. I imagine more than a few parents exchanged glances as they quickly exited the parking lot, trying to minimize possibility of their daughters witnessing such wild parenting. I don't blame them. It was probably too much. So on the way home, I looked in the rearview mirror, and I saw a little cloud of sadness pass across my girl's countenance. Broke my heart a bit, said, "Hey, babe, that was too much. I'm so sorry." She snatched a tear, said, "It's okay, Dad. I know you're trying to make me better." Good grief. A 10-year-old isn't supposed to be so patient. Didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Still don't. During middle school years, I'd find her in her room, busy with homework, journal, music. I'd bump her pencil, jab her arm, toss a pillow at her. Usually morphed into a game. We'd see who could push who off the bed. Usually ended same way. Crooked lampshade, laughter, me on the floor, her jumping on top of me. Sometimes she wasn't into it. It's hard to imagine. She'd tolerate it for a minute, then tell me to leave, and then I'd have to find her brothers and mess with them. Most of my parenting approach was to annoy the kids until they started wrestling with me. If I was a neurologist, I'd probably write about neurochemicals, the way they're released when we physically interact with loved ones. I've loved being a dad. Lots of neurochemicals.
You you pause there in the middle of the reading, and I wonder if, Jonathan, you would share whatever's appropriate about the pause. I'm sure as you're reading, there's pictures and images and scenes that come to mind, but if you would give us access to whatever you feel like is wise.
It's a bit out of body experience. You know, it's a bit like, there's multiple things going on. First of all, I'm writing about this thing that was so important to me, this person, and it's been 10 years, but it's still so real. And then sometimes I don't know how to articulate it. Like there's a sense of her being with me, but not in like not like she's sitting on my shoulder or anything, but just an essence of it. And so that kind of messes me up a little bit. But also another thing that messes me up, a thing that's been crazy, is that like this isn't the only loss we've had in 10 years. In some ways, though, these things are not quantifiable. And I wouldn't want to suggest that. But in some ways, the loss of her was the most intense. But we've been through so much death and so much loss. And like at one point a few years ago, I was excommunicated from my denomination and, you know, had to surrender credentials. And not to mention that led to having to close our church and COVID and parents dying and nieces and nephews. And it's been an insane decade. And so when I pause there, it never quite feels like it was just that one thing that happened. It kind of feels like the whole thing, and there's even stuff that goes back even further than that. It's like one slow motion kind of car wreck. And so I'm still living it, and I'm trying to be, what am I trying to be? Like, I'm trying to be present to it, but without losing my mind, you know, also without breaking down and crying on the, you know, Gravity podcast. That'd be a bummer. So it's just, there's just multiple storylines going on in my head, and it's too much. And so thankfully I was able to pause and at least collect myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
You know, we don't have the same activating events Jonathan does, but how the last 10 years has felt like this long avalanche of too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think probably a lot of people feel that way, especially in our culture, going through so much change. So I think probably a lot of people relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely felt, again, I think there was power in your reading of that. Now that poem, the section of the book was a lot more directly related, right? The words were directly related to your experiences with your daughter, but there was still, I mean, something caught in me as well. I was glad I didn't have to read it.
I should have made you guys read this. Why am I reading this?
That's what, you know, we should have done that. Let's start it over. Eliminate all this. No.
Right.
But yeah, it touched something I don't know, wordless within me that sort of touched on my own experiences of grief. So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Something powerful about it. So.
I'm committed to grieving, but grief is like this, irascible scoundrel that doesn't show up when I schedule grief into my calendar. And so I'm kind of always, I have this weird, complicated relationship with where I have a grief aversion. I don't want to be sad, but whenever grief shows up for me, comes online for me, I'm like, oh, there it is. Man, there's a mountain of it here and it's on its own schedule. And, I know sometimes that we don't have that choice. Like, I think grief inhabits our bodies differently. Some people can't get away from their grief. Some people can't find their grief. I wonder, as you've lived these 10 years with a very present grief that you mentioned has accumulations to it, what has grief wanted with you? And what have you learned as you've sought to honor that grief?
Yeah, those are wide open questions. So much comes to mind. I started thinking when you were talking about, something about movement, about the ebb and flow of the thing. Like, it's always working. Grief is not a one-time event and then you do it and you're done and it's in your rearview mirror. You know, there is the actual event, of course, that is, but it gives off all these vibrations that ebb and flow throughout your whole life. I think grief, you know, it's pain and it's beauty. It's very synonymous with love. It never really stops. It's flowing in tributaries in and out of our lives and out of the lives of our culture and the lives of creation. And sometimes we're more open to it than others. I think it's always open to us, but sometimes for whatever reason, our body or psyche or spirit isn't quite open. So yeah, it's good that you have enough wisdom to recognize when it's coming online, so to speak. Although grief isn't digital, it's very analog.
it's such an insufficient metaphor to describe it.
But. No, it's a good metaphor. It just only captures a part of it, like all metaphors do.
Yeah.
So when you kind of feel that, my question was, how do you respond when you feel it coming online? Like what do you do in those moments? How are you present to it?
Yeah, well, I breathe.
Yeah, me too.
I breathe. And I find that I have inherited I've inherited stories about, and there are all kinds of layers, or gendered stories, and their stage of life stories. But I don't find that I give myself permission to be sad. And I find that there's like this default, again, I'll use another technological metaphor. There's a default operating system in me that immediately goes about solving my sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, sadness is a disease and I have to cure it. And I think that part of what grief is teaching me is that sad things make us sad, and it's okay to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this—that's the truest thing you can tell about sad things, is to feel them.
That's right.
And that's so hard for me, man.
And when you, so there's something here. It's very interesting. When you feel this sadness and this grief, it is like a weight, and it does compress you, and it does cause things to, I have noticed that it attenuates my periphery. And so I'm kind of focused here, and I'm moving slower because things are heavier. Yeah. I'm more focused, but I'm more deliberate. So it also brings something really interesting and not joyful, but there's joy in that. There's beauty in that as well, because now I'm noticing things better. And so as I think about that, I think about what I think is happening with love. Like, love as an abstract idea is great, but it doesn't really mean much. Love, I think, is constantly trying to express itself down into the, into the ends of our fingers and toes. And, mm-hmm. Otherwise it's just this abstract eternal form that lives somewhere. And so what I suspect is happening is, I keep looking up like I'm going to find an answer up here. What I suspect
that's
is
where I look to for answers.
Yeah, is that love, in its interest in moving, engages with the sadness that's moving us, and it becomes entangled, and that there's something really beautiful where it's all going, but it is movement, it is breathing. It is, it's not, I think our culture conditions us, and maybe even more so as those of us who identify more masculine, although it's not just my masculinity or the culture, it's also me. I have adopted some of it, but we tend to think that, here this thing comes and we got to stop it and locate it and dominate it, control it, mm-hmm. and it's going to stay here. Well, actually, in some ways, when we do that, it does stay in our body. Our body keeps the score, you know. So there's what I'm thinking as I hear you talk and as I kind of relate to it is this, the movement piece of it and how there's something really beautiful, all that. And love has got, you know, love is indefatigable. Love, I think, I only know some of this by faith, but also I know a lot of it by lived experience, that love never gives up. Love is patient. Love keeps going. And it will, I'm hesitating. I keep trying not to use the word use. So I don't want to say love uses sadness because I don't really like that, but love dances with it and is entangled with it, all trying to move us from where we are to the next thing. Not because where we are is bad. It's not like love is, it's not like, oh, that's, it's just, it's movement. Everything moves. Otherwise, there's no such thing as static. That's not reality. The reality is movement, and love's got somewhere that wants us to go. So that's kind of what I started thinking about when I heard you say that.
I before you said entanglement, I was thinking that another surprise of grief for me is that it is correlated to love, and that my capacity to love is related to my openness and consent to grief.
Yeah, it seems like. Somebody that means a lot to us said, blessed are those who mourn. Well, that must mean something.
It must. Well, on that note, Jesus take the podcast. The book, I use humor to not feel things. The book is called Indigo, B-minus humor. Indigo, The Color of Grief. Jonathan, there are three books that I've read that have helped me get in my body to feel grief. One is The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
One is interesting because he writes in a way that's not very embodied. It's very kind of stark, but I love that book too.
The other is Lament for a Son by Nicholas Wolterstorff.
Yep, that'll mess you up.
And your book did it to me too.
That's nice. Thank you.
So thank you so much for this gift. And thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, we could have just done a 30-minute reading of his book. I had that thought 20 minutes into the podcast. But what an interesting experience that would be to just listen to a book like this on audio, just being read to you by the author. 'Cause I do think there's something that you can't understand unless you listen.
If we would have done that, we probably would have gotten the copyright trouble though if we did that. So, because there is an audiobook available.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's white collar crime. We'd be fine.
So anyway, listener, if you are interested in the audiobook, I think you can get it on. I'm looking at the link here. You can get it on Audible for Amazon, at least.
I also want to mention that you can go to Jonathan Foster online to see more about Jonathan, including a link to his newsletter, which is his Substack, fosterj.substack.com. He writes about a lot of stuff. And he and Tom Ward are friends, and we had Tom Ward on a few months ago, and we're going to have him on here shortly again. And they both got kicked out of other denominations for being too kind to LGBTQ folks. So he's got a book about that too. Anywho.
Yeah. I really appreciated hearing from him. I find that I'm not, you know, I don't have the training to call myself like an academic theologian. But I find that when I want to write theologically, I find myself leaning into, I don't know, what you might call theopoetics. I find myself leaning into, I don't know, less
propositional, categories. Didactic kind of stuff.
And into more sort of like evocative, you know, less, I don't know, the language isn't quite as defined.
I do appreciate him saying, you know, the medium is the message. Mm-hmm. Quoting Marshall McLuhan, we're doing a study at our church on Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on 1 John. And 1 John has always been, you know, it's people say it's their favorite. You know, if you're just pulling like a phrase out, this is how we know what love is, because God loved us and gave his son as an atoning sacrifice. Like, people love those things. But if you try to like treat 1 John as like a Pauline letter and sort of graph that out as a didactic sort of, it resists that.
Mm.
And so one of the things we're talking about how is the style of 1 John is a rhetorical style that was meant to do a certain kind of work.
Yeah.
And that kind of work isn't as well known or as important to us today. And so we miss it. We miss the work the style is doing. And I think one of the benefits of coming alongside, listening in to Jonathan as he gives expression to and reflection of his grief is that the style serves that in a way that perhaps just explaining or defining grief wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a sense in which you have to sort of and this happens, I think, with any work of poetry, you have to, before you can do any productive work of analysis, if you are going to do some analysis, you know, on like anything, any poem, or, you know, 1 John or whatever, it's almost like you have to let the poem do something to you or something in you first. Like you have to submit to the rhythm of the poem and just like let it do what it's going to do before you can really understand, rather than try to shove it into a predetermined box of, oh, this is, you know, this is what a New Testament epistle is supposed to be and what it's supposed to be like, or this is what a book about grief is supposed to be like, you know. I found it really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And listener, I think we're interested. Obviously, there's other podcasts that talk about poetry or poetics more often, but I am keenly interested in how we gain access to and faithful tending to our collective grief.
Yeah.
It's a real thing, man.
Yep. Man. Dude.
And I think it's incumbent upon those of us who want to order our lives in love, following Jesus, that we not only focus on love, but we focus on those things that impact our capacity for love.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that grief is one of them.
Yes. Yeah, I think when he was talking about love and grief, and just as you're talking about it now, I think one of the things I realized was that I think that implicitly what I'm doing when I allow myself to lament and to grieve or to enter into any like emotionally difficult circumstance, emotionally or spiritually, like anytime I enter into that, whether it's just me feeling something, you know, alone in my, you know, room, or it's like a conversation that I'm not looking forward to or something I've got to bring up. You know what I mean? Like anything like that, where there's the reality of it feels really big, overwhelming, and scary. I think implicitly I have to trust love in order to step into it.
Yes.
I have to trust, okay, well, this is big. It's really scary. Probably with my own resources, I don't think I have enough to deal with this. I'm not smart enough. I'm not healthy enough. I'm not whole enough. I'm not healed enough.
Yeah.
But maybe love is big enough and will carry me. I think I have to trust love to step into any of this stuff.
Well, you better get on with it then. Do it.
Yes. Anyway, I hope that's encouraging to you, listener, because sometimes I think it can feel daunting to be like, am I grieving right? Am I doing this right?
Man, that I think sucks. That's a sucky place to be in for me. Just to say, like, anytime I feel like I'm doing grief wrong or I'm not doing it right or I failed grieving, it leads, it's no good. There be dragons.
There do be dragons. there.
It's bad.
So anyway, so I think, I hope it feels encouraging, because I think I have felt so encouraged that it's like, oh, this is something I can actually do. Like, I just have to, I don't have to know what I'm doing. I just have to step into this and sort of just, I just have to, you know, come up with enough faith in love to just step into it and just trust that it's going to be okay somehow, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, and that feels like something I can actually do.
All right. That's a good last word.
I think so.
We'll leave it there for today, and we'll come back next week with, I don't know, we'll have to do something else.
Something a dad joke or something? Something a little more lighthearted?
There's no worse dad jokes. This is a serious podcast, and we're talking about grief and love.
How dare I even suggest?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well. All right. Until next time.
Peace.
Peace, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast that talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.